Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast, and we're back with a banger. You voted them in, so we got them in. Phil, Max. Phil, can you please introduce yourself?
All right, Maz. Phil Morehouse. Used to be a science teacher. I now discuss political commentary, mostly on British politics, although there's the orange one creeping into it a lot more these days on the YouTube channel, A Different Bias.
And Max.
My name is Max. I run the Robespierre channel, where I used to talk mainly about Brexit, but Brexit has gone to the back burner. So I'm now talking about politics in general, including British politics, Irish politics from time to time, and of course, what's happening across the pond with Agent Orange.
Much happened over the summer as we had a break.
Not in Britain, Max. No.
Max, did much happen over the summer?
I can't think of anything interesting that happened over the summer. Can you, Alex? It's been a very quiet
riots.
Summer. Maybe it's because when Parliament goes into recess, everything shuts down. And I know Phil calls it silly season, which is...
Well, it's not me that calls it. That is actually what it's known as. I mean, that is the official term for it.
Silly
season. Just technically, we haven't really had one until this summer, for a while anyway, because although MPs weren't providing drama in the past few years, the government tended to, and then last summer we had the riots. So this is the first silly season I've actually covered since I've been doing political commentary on YouTube, really.
Oh, really?
Because there's always been stuff going on, like, you know, whether it was Boris Johnson or Rishi, I can't say Liz Truss because she never actually managed to get through a summer, or Rishi Sunak, they always provided stuff. So my views were always fine over summer, over the past few years, until this summer. So then I had to start doing more, you know, sort of more evergreen stuff, which I don't usually do that much of. Some people obviously do that all the time. I tend to do like breaking news, but there wasn't really much breaking news.
I don't know. You had the riots that sort of flared up again.
That was last year, yeah.
Well, it was protests then. I'm calling them protests, to be
honest.
Well,
yeah, but you do one video on that. A bunch of racists outside of things shouting.
And then there's Donald Trump sending troops into Washington.
See, that's geopolitics. Obviously, the rest of the world doesn't go into recess. So no. There's always news around the world to lean into, certainly.
And then you've got the rise of reform, supposedly.
But also something I thought was interesting is when Parliament was in recess, Farage was not. And Farage was doing conferences and doing campaigns and stuff like that. And I think this is a bit of a problem because, you know, Labour and the Tories went on holiday, basically. And Farage said, I'm not going on holiday. I went on holiday before, but I'm getting down. I'm getting to work now. And maybe it's a clever strategy.
So it's where Labour have a problem there, and they can't compete with that, but they can't come out with lots of new policies, because then when Parliament comes back into session, Lindsay Hoyle will scream his head off at them, because the government is supposed to announce new things to MPs first. So they get into terrible trouble if they announce it to the media first. But there's plenty of stuff that Labour have already been doing. It's already been announced to Parliament, it's passed through Parliament, that a lot of the public don't know about. They could have just been leaning into that. They could have been talking about the workers' rights. They could have been talking about renters' rights and the NHS and housing and energy. They could have done plenty on stuff that's already been announced, but no sod heard it the first time round.
Do you think that will change now that they have a new communications director or whatever?
We'll have to see. I mean, it's now the third communications director since they came to power in just over a year. It's the third one within the space of a year, because the last one was appointed last October. So, like, we'll just have to see. It depends what the reason is for the fact that they just don't understand communication. Like, for my money, they keep leaning into asylum issues where even when people approve of it, there's, you know, Maureen commented some polling. Like, when people find out what Labour are doing on asylum, they go, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I now think even less well of Labour. So it's like, so even when they explain to the public what they're doing and the public approve of it, people hate Labour more because of it.
I saw
So what they should do is talk about the stuff that's popular.
What are they doing that you think is popular? What would you put?
So the workers' rights.
Let's play a little bit of role play. Phil, you're put in charge for comms. You can do three things to boost their comms, like whatever you want. What would you do?
First thing is do what's proven to work around the world. Keir Starmer or some other very senior minister, you get journalists round to Downing Street every single morning. And you just nice and formal. Do you remember when Hamza Yousaf first became SNP leader? And I was quite impressed with his first sort of proper press conference, because it wasn't a proper. He just got a load of armchairs and sofas around. He just sat around with journalists and talked to them. Do that, right? And don't just have, you invite obviously all of the top political journalists from the main, but also you invite some others, more independent ones as well. And just come in, and one day you're going to talk about, like, what there's like there's dozens of new things in the employment rights bill. So you can do like one, that can be, you know, what one you do every week. And you just come in and you start talking about one aspect of that, or the renters' rights bill, or what's going on with housing, or what's going on with the NHS, Best Start centres, childcare, education. There's a massive, what, get water companies, the fact that they're taking on like dodgy water companies. There's a list as long as your arm of things they can talk. They will never run out of material. Just come in. And the reason I say that is because then you do what Trump and other leaders around the world do. You control the news cycle. You decide what they're going to talk about.
Yep.
You can't decide how they talk about it. You can decide what they talk about. Because if you get the top political journalists are not going to turn down an invitation to Downing Street.
Nope.
So they've got to get there. Let's say you're going to get kicked off at 10 o'clock. So they've got to get there. They've got to get to Downing Street. They've got to get through one set of security. Right. So that takes time. Then they've got to get through another just to get inside the bloody building. Right. Then they've got to get sent to whichever room you're going to put. I wouldn't do it in that stupid press conference room. I'd do it in a more comfortable room. Sofas, armchairs, do what Yusuf did. And give them some croissants and a cup of tea or whatever. Deliberately make them wait 15 minutes. Come out. Talk to them for an hour. No, seriously.
Go on, sorry.
So talk to them for an hour. You're deciding what you're talking about. They'll ask you questions. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. But you keep on with your topics you want to talk about. Two or three topics. We know Starmer can do that. We know he ain't got much charisma. But we know he can do that because he does it in PMQs. Like, yep. You don't get to decide what the questions are in PMQs. But he manages PMQs well enough. He can manage this well enough. Then, you know, you do that for an hour. Then you sod off. And then they've got to get back. By the time they're back to the office, it's lunchtime. They're going to have the lunch, right? And then what they're going to do in the afternoon? They've spent their entire morning talking about this thing. They're not going to then start writing about something completely different because they've wasted their morning. So
this is good in other countries. It's really interesting.
It's how you do it. Like, you need to capture the news cycle. There's two ways to capture a news cycle. First of all, you need a stunt that's really good for clickbait, which is difficult. There are only so many. I mean, Nigel Farage, the reason why he ever became to Promise is he was quite good at that. But often you have to say something quite outrageous, which is a little bit risky for a government. Unless, of course, you're a government of the sort of Trump. But if you're a serious government, should we say, it's a bit risky to just come out with outrageous things. Although I do think they could be a bit more in your face. And so the second way is just to make sure that all the top political journalists have to spend their entire morning focused on what you want to talk about. And also it would mean that they'd then be talking about stuff where Nigel Farage is less comfortable. Every time they come out and talk about asylum, which they keep doing regularly, inevitably, they're going to go and ask Nigel Farage what he thinks, because he's like, he's Mr. Asylum, Mr. Immigration, or Mr. Anti-Asylum in this case. Whereas if they talk about workers' rights, what they're going to ask him, why did you vote against them? They're going to ask him about renters' rights bill, why did you vote against it? All of these things.
Did you see the interview that people did in Clacton, where they were asking people about that?
Yeah.
Do you think that companies should be allowed to sack you unless you agree to worse pay and worse conditions?
No.
No.
Do you think that if you're working for a company for less than 2 years,
right,
they have the right to dismiss you without any good reason?
No.
No.
Well, how can they sack you if they haven't got a good reason?
Of course not.
Okay, so next one. Do you think that company should be able to decide the hours you work based on what suits them?
No.
No.
It just happened to me. Hours cut down.
It's another no.
So there is a bill proposed in Parliament right now.
Right.
That is to get rid of all these bad practices.
That'd be good.
Any idea someone who voted against the bill?
Business people, obviously.
The employer. Company owners.
Shall I give you a clue? Your MP.
Nigel. No.
Really?
I did think he was more for the people.
I thought he was working for the public.
Next time he brings his tank around and waving at people, I'll just say to him, hang on a minute, mate, I want to speak to you.
That was pretty special when they thought, oh, I've got to go and have words with Nigel. I'm like, no, you're not. he doesn't allow you to talk to him in person.
Well, no, exactly.
Number three, Bill. What's number three? What was your...
I've just done number one. I haven't done two yet. That was just... What? That's my one thing. Get a bloody journalist in every day. The second thing is... I have hinted at number two.
Okay.
Stop talking about things that make the public think less well of you, which is asylum. They have to do something. I get that they have to lean into a bit of the anti-immigration stuff because the public's just got that idea in their head now. But
I'd argue with that. You could so be the antithesis to that. You could easily, you could start up a campaign of let's kick racism out of Britain, and that would stunt that. I don't agree with the immigration side of things. What's that?
It hasn't done it.
No, he hasn't done it, but he could do it, and that's...
No, it hasn't. No, people have done those campaigns, big campaigns. When? Hasn't done anything.
Last time I heard that was football. And they were doing, let's kick racism out of football. I've not heard anyone start up a campaign of kick racism out of Britain. Not a single party's brought
it. Well, they haven't kicked it out of football.
They've done it's really mixed, because obviously you go, look, you kick it out of the stadiums, but you don't kick it out of society. What you need is a campaign within the UK to go, let's be anti-racist. And how the hell does Farage argue with that? Like, it's a really easy,
because it's easy to argue. He does it all the time. It just says it's not racist to have concerns about this.
Yeah, but you're not saying that. You're saying get rid of racism.
You have to have a discussion at some point what it means.
You could set up a committee and
then they'll say,
and then
it
comes down to education, surely. That's what it all seems to come down to, is education.
They're claiming they're doing it for the kids. Anyway, the second point is...
Sorry,
the second point is Never mind. You don't talk about asylum, because Farage is strong on asylum. They cannot outbid Farage on asylum. It's like, oh, we're going to reduce it. Yeah, he's going to get rid of it altogether. So he says. Mm. He hasn't got any policies to actually do it, but so he says. So you can't outbid Farage on it.
He won't do it.
So the second thing is stop talking completely. Answer questions. You don't blank questions. If a journalist asks you about asylum, talk about asylum. But don't feed it with your own bandwidth. If you do a press conference, under no circumstances, do it on something that benefits Nigel Farage. The third thing I would do is I would have a proper social media strategy. They haven't got one. Oh. They actually do have a large communications team. And I'm not disparaging individual people on it, but the aims and objectives are really bad.
You can criticise Labour, Phil. We're a safe space. You can criticise their comms.
I just have done. Their communication is absolutely terrible. It's appalling. If their communication, like a lot of what they're doing in terms of managing the country, is really good. Like, you take the economy, for example, constant bad news about the economy in the newspapers.
Yeah.
Not the economic newspapers. It's constant good news.
It's true.
Constantly. You know, Lloyd's just produced their survey recently. You'll see the Telegraph and the Daily Mail happily publish things about businesses going, oh, it's absolutely terrible. It's national insurance thing. Oh, it's killing us. It's killing us. We're not hiring. That is just them lobbying, because they're trying to get Rachel Reeves to reduce taxes because they want to make more money. But business confidence, as surveyed by Lloyds, who've been doing this for many, many years, has said it's the highest it's been since 2014.
Wow.
Back when
that's really interesting.
A few people knew Nigel Farage was, and that was about it.
I still don't... I mean, inflation's still quite high. It's higher than the EU.
It's higher than it'll ideally be, yes. We have problems with that. We also have problems with borrowing costs, because even though our debt is not as serious as some of the G7 countries, somehow it ends up costing more for us. So there are issues still, although, as Bailey was saying, the Telegraph undermined themselves. It was quite funny. It was one of these classic things. They had a thing talking about how, you know, the borrowing cost was, you know, really terrible stuff. And yet they also had next to it a headline where Andrew Bailey's explaining it's actually fairly average for a G7 country.
That's interesting.
You know, Germany and Japan, for example, theirs is higher than ours, America's lower. We're in the middle of the pack. And also it's all part of the same, this increase in the cost of borrowing. It's caused by changes with pension funds that's affecting every other G7 nation as well.
Wow. Max, what are your three? What are your three things? Because there's some really interesting stuff there from...
Yeah, so really, no, and I think some of the things that Phil has said, I'd probably copy and paste myself. Like, for example, I like the idea of him sitting down, Prime Minister sitting down with people every day and saying, these are the policies, this is what we're doing. I'd sort of expand it into maybe a weekly sort of podcast or something where you know, somebody within the party or even the Prime Minister sits down with somebody in a very informal context and just talks about, you know, what's happening this week, what are they doing, and talks about some of the issues. Because I think a lot of people don't know anything about Starmer. They don't know what it is.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Positions are on things, and I think this could, it couldn't do any harm. I was mentioning this on the live stream. I was saying, like, you know, what has he got to lose if he does this? So I think there could be some advantage in getting to know the public, allowing the public to know a bit more about him. He comes across as very stiff. He comes across, and maybe this is not all that important for people. They care more about what the government is actually doing as opposed to who's in charge. But I think they need to have a vision. If you look at the other political parties, the Tories, their vision is we want to make rich people richer. Reform, it's about we want to stop immigration. The Greens, you know, the environment, the SNP, independence. And then, you know, whatever, most parties have a vision. And when we think of Labour, we think of, well, a party for the working class, for the poorest in society, the most vulnerable. And that's not coming across. So they need to do something about that. They need to have a vision. When it comes to the different, when they're being interviewed about immigration and stuff, yeah, agree 100% with Phil. They need to redirect the conversation towards their, it needs to be about what their strengths are. So they should not be talking about immigration. They shouldn't be talking about asylum because it's only helping Farage. I go a step further. I say, whenever the issue of immigration is brought up, redirect the conversation to something that's a strength of the party. So for example, if people are talking about immigration, okay, well, what are some of the issues that people are concerned about? Housing. Okay, what are we doing on housing? We're building more houses. We have a plan to build 1.5 million homes. But what about immigrants going into those houses? Well, in order to have these homes, we need to build them. We need people to come in. We need to have a robust and fair immigration system so we can build the houses. Don't we want to build these homes? Yes, of course we do. We need to do these things. So I think whenever the issue of immigration is brought up, you need to redirect it into a strength. So talk about if they talk about immigration, well, we need the NHS needs workers. We need to bring people in to work in the NHS, and then use some statistics, like, for example, a quarter of all workers, or a third, I think it is, of workers in the NHS are foreigners. So play to the strengths, I think. I don't know if this is going to work, but it's better than allowing Farage to set the narrative. So it has to be a case of you setting the narrative, you saying, this is what we're going to talk about. And I saw it with Farage whenever he was on Newsnight or on the BBC or whatever. Whatever the topic was, he would redirect it, you know, before Brexit, back to, well, we need to leave the European Union. So whenever an issue like housing was brought up, he would redirect it to, well, the only way to fix this problem is leaving the European Union. Or now, the only way to fix this problem is bringing down immigration. So do the flip. If the issue is immigration, then okay, then what are the issues related to immigration? Housing, the NHS, public services. Okay, what are we going to do? We're going to fix these things. We need, don't allow the journalists just to set the narrative of immigration, redirect it to something that's a strength of yours. So that would be the first thing, of course, would be sitting down with journalists, getting your vision across, getting people to understand what the government want to achieve by the end of the parliament. Not so much targets, but a vision. And it always has to work towards that vision. Now, I still don't know what the vision is, but they need to come up with one. The other point, of course, is setting the narrative. So if the journalists start talking about immigration, you redirect it to something positive. And I think, thirdly, like Phil has said, they need to have some sort of real social media platform or some sort of presence. Like, a lot of the stuff that I've seen from Labour on social media is either videos of Starmer walking slowly with other people or memes. And that's not going to cut through with people.
No, it's not.
So you need, look at what Farage is doing. I'm not saying to copy Farage, but look at what he's doing. He's doing interviews with people on the street. He's doing, why can't Starmer or somebody like Starmer go down to the local village or town or whatever and meet with people and do an interview with them? Ask them, okay, what are your concerns? What concerns are housing? Okay, let's sit down and talk about that. Maybe it's not very sexy. Maybe immigration is much more interesting for people and it grabs more clicks and likes, but they need to have some sort of presence online.
And they don't.
Maybe they're sticking with some sort of 2010 model where you have your video pieces and you just pump those out, but things have completely changed. You notice how Farage has almost every week some sort of press conference, some sort of conference, and he attracts all the media. Labour need to do something like that.
Not the ones he bans.
No, like in York, not Yorkshire or Lincolnshire? Where was it?
Nottinghamshire.
Nottinghamshire, okay.
Was it Nottingham?
Yeah.
Nottinghamshire.
So it's in Lee Anderson's territory?
I suppose so.
Yeah, that's
Ashfield,
interesting.
I think, is Nottinghamshire.
Because he's a lying little scumbag, isn't he? When he had to falsify his neighbour, mate, didn't he? Remember that?
Yeah. Lee Anderson, your parliamentary candidate for the Conservative Party. How are you doing? I recognise you. It's Steve, isn't it? Yeah, I recognise you. How you doing, mate? All right.
Yes,
I'm just doing a bit of last-minute campaigning. Are you going to be voting on December the 12th? And do you mind me asking which way you're going to go this time?
Well, I'm going with you. There's no way Labour are ever going to get my vote again.
And he liked Mr. Anderson's very personal policy initiative this week.
I watched that video.
Yeah.
What do you mean, putting antisocial people in tents?
Yeah, I did.
He's not allowed to talk about that now.
I think you're a bit soft on it.
Soft?
Yeah.
What would you do then?
I'd give cat and nine tails for.
Cat and nine tails?
Make them wear a pink tutu.
Pink tutu?
That'd stop them going round bullying anybody.
What about that?
I can't support this. Can we just cut there for one moment, please?
You can't support the cat of nine tails.
No, I can't support that. He obviously got very strong opinions, but you know,
very strong.
But I can't support that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. But I mean, is this? It's almost like it's been set up for us.
Set up? Well, more than I'd realised. For it was only after Lee Anderson had left us that my cameraman producer had the chance to tell me that because Anderson was wearing one of our radio microphones, we'd managed to record him setting up the apparently spontaneous doorstep encounter beforehand. Watch and listen. You can just see Anderson on the phone behind me.
Just make out you know who I am. You know I'm the candidate, but not a friend. All right. I'm at staff car park. Have a quick look. Yeah? All right, my daughter, I'll see you in a minute. See you, mate.
At the time, Anderson said, the call was merely about campaign material.
All right, I'd best turn this off. Some leaflets have just come for me, so...
In all my years filming elections, I've long suspected that certain candidates have set up friendly voters to make them look that much more popular. But this is the first time we've caught some candidate blatantly in the act. A lesson to us, journalists and viewers, that in this world of fake news, we should be a little bit more sceptical about what we see on screen.
2019, yeah.
But what about you, Alex? What would you do to improve?
I really like Phil's idea. Just getting him in, making way around, get him back out by lunchtime, give him a nice spread to keep him in. But it's the social media. It's interesting because you both touched on it. Zach Polanski is now doing a podcast on a Wednesday. He's nailed it. He's like, and he's going to talk to a different person every single week. And he had Ash from Navora, who's a communist, and had a good old chin wag with her. And now he's going, right, podcast every Wednesday. And it's very much touching on...
But he needs to also have people on who disagree with him.
Yeah.
Who would agree with him. So one thing is to... And it's quite difficult. I've been trying to reach out to people who disagree with me to have, you know, to have a discussion or a debate. And it's extremely difficult. But he needs to have people on who will... be controversial, not controversial as in racist or bigoted, but people who will disagree with him, because that will attract more and more people to him, that it would bring people on who are interested to hear what he has to say, but also what they have to say. And you need this sort of controversy in order to attract people.
Oh, God, are we playing to the algorithm here?
Yeah.
Well, the thing 100%. Is, like, if he just does podcasts where he talks to people from that sort of thing, like, he's already setting the Green Party to be sort of very much of a crossover with, the Your Party, isn't he? So all he's going to do is appeal to the people who are already going to vote either Green or Your Party, depending on maybe how they think they will do in their particular constituency. He's not going to garner more support for the Greens. And the key thing about the Green Party, the Green Party are the most inefficient of all parties, of the mainstream parties, because they get their sort of, the number of votes they need per seat won is really high. So if he says he wants to win 30 seats, right? So he has to identify where are those 30 seats, who are the key voters that are richest seen. This is all the stuff Labour did last time, except they needed to win 140. But he needs to say, right, if he's got an idea, if he's not just making it up, if he's not just pulling numbers out of his arse, that means he needs to go, right, well, these are the 30 seats I'm going to target. These are the key voters there that I can potentially bring on board. And this is it, I'm going to do it. And he hasn't explained any of those three things. So if he does his podcast, he needs to use that pod. Everything he does, if he has got a genuine 30 figure in mind, has to be with the aim of appealing to those. And all I see at the moment is I don't actually see any evidence that he's got that in mind.
I think they have been targeting seats. I know that they're short of cash, which is a big issue. Like, they haven't got the clout that the other parties do because they haven't got billionaires chucking or Russians chucking money at them. But but that would be one of the key limiters. It's interesting. I think Farage was asked about that and he said, no, money's not important. It's like, well, fucking is. Like, how else do you run a campaign unless you've got cash?
Well, because he gets a load of free publicity. He gets a load of people providing him a lot of free publicity that doesn't have to be included on the expenses form.
You'd still need, like, your social media team alone is probably going to cost you, if you did it properly for a nationwide
campaign.
That's
if you've got your own social media team.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the point being, like, you're talking like 250k if you wanted to do it properly just for the social media team.
I can reel off a list of 10 people on YouTube who get, hundreds of thousands of views a day that are his free social media team.
That I agree with, but you still need your own in-house one.
It doesn't have to be a massive operation. Doesn't have to be a massive operation.
250 wouldn't be. You're talking like a social media manager is about 60 to 70K. And then you pay for like two or three people underneath you. That's 30 to 50. That's not a massive team. That's just how much it costs.
Yeah, but that's
and that's not even including the advertising budget. Even you need stunt budgets if you're going to do that stuff. Like, it's about, if you wanted to do it nationwide, it's about 200, 250 because the staff and the budget you need. And I'm not saying you can't do it free as well. Because, like, you'd still have, like, a producer.
Yeah, but Reform, even the Green Party can afford that.
You think they could or couldn't?
No, they can. I know they can because they have to publish their donations. I know what they all get, that all of them can afford a social media team if they wanted one.
And I think, actually, Zach will probably increase the donations. It will result in more donations because he's there. Whether you like him or not, but I think he is going to attract controversy.
But who from? Where are these donations coming from? Who do you think he's going to elicit them
at the moment? I think there's a support base, but I think on the other side of that, because Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana have jumped into this, I think this is actually going to damage the Green Party more
than
it
does. That's what I mean. So if you think he's going to elicit more of donations, I'm going to ask where from, because as far as I can see, he's positioning the Green Party with a big overlap over a new party that is itself going to elicit donations. So where are the donations for the Green Party going to come from?
I guess it depends, doesn't it? There must be billionaires out there who'll go, okay, I'm pro-green, I want to support climate change. I think Zach's got a vision. I'm more likely to put more money in as a result.
I just have to point out the Green Party are not in favour of climate change. So anyone who's promoting climate change...
anti-climate change, thank you.
But then wouldn't they say, wouldn't this person look at the... I mean, what are the Green Party proposing that Labour are not doing?
Taxing billionaires?
Give me a policy that the Green Party have that Labour are not doing.
Taxing billionaires? Green revolution?
No, for climate change.
for Green.
Also, Labour. They are, because this is a complete misnomer. Labour have actually massively increased taxes on the rich. They just don't get reported. Tens of billions. Right.
So,
but
what,
in terms of climate change, you've specifically talked about a billionaire donor who wants to promote anti-climate change. So what do the Green Party have as a climate policy that Labour don't?
I guess the manifesto needs to come out before we can make that judgment. Well, and the manifesto hasn't come out.
What? Oh, no, his hasn't come out.
Yeah,
but what
exactly.
I'm saying
that's
is
the problem.
The situation at the moment is the Green Party don't actually have any policies that Labour don't.
That was the same problem we had with the election, because everyone kept sort of saying, oh, this is what they've said. And I kept saying, well, you can't do anything until the manifesto comes out. And that's a problem that you're going to have. But it's also an advantage for a lot of parties. They won't release it until, you know, 6 months to a year before the election, so they don't get heavy criticism.
That's absolutely true. I can't
really answer that. The impression I'm getting, though, is that he's, from what he said, is that he wants to increase taxes on the rich. I mean, we used to have a tax threshold of 90%, didn't we, on the ultra rich? Is that what Labour's doing?
So, no, because, again, you'd have the issue of capital flight. The problem is the populists at the moment, when they're talking about taxing the rich, they're talking about taxing mobile wealth. And they're not serious, because if you tax mobile wealth, it's mobile. They move it. It's really easy to move it.
What they
should be talking about is what all the serious economists talk about. You don't go more than 2 weeks without an actual genuine economist, a professor of economics, a Nobel Prize winning economist. Mm. It's been going back for over 100 years. If you want to tax wealth, you tax wealth that can't be moved, which is land and property. The only people, in terms of political groups, literally the only party talking about taxing property and land is Labour. Now, they've not come out and said, we're definitely doing this, but they are literally the only party talking about it. Everyone else is just, I'm sorry, at this point, they're just, I don't know what they're doing, right? Because they know you cannot, if you tax something that's mobile, they just move it. Like when you have this thing about, oh, but you know, they always said the billionaires would leave the country and they didn't, stuff like that. They don't need to leave the country. It's really like people don't understand. They just think that billionaires are people who are like them, but with shitloads more money. No, they're not. Like a billionaire let's say they're living in Britain, they've got to pay taxes in Britain, stuff like that, because non-dom stuff's going away, even if foreign. But if they're a billionaire living in Britain, they're not really a billionaire living in Britain. They're a billionaire who say their primary residence is Britain, but they've also got homes in other countries around the world. Mm. And if they don't like a sudden change in the tax regime, they just suddenly decide they're now living somewhere else. They're still living in Britain some of the year, but they just switch to their primary residence to a different territory where they think the tax regime is better. Like, there is no way of taxing mobile wealth unless you have international agreement. So when we did used to tax the rich properly, so did America, so did France, so did Germany, so did Italy, so did everyone else. There was nowhere to move your wealth. What's happened since is Thatcher and Reagan completely changed that. They completely got rid of that. But also you've had emerge countries around the world that are now much more appealing as well. So, you know, the classic thing about UAE, for example, and Singapore, which was attractive to a certain person who said Brexit would be great for the country.
Cost of food, clothing and footwear. The price of food, of clothing, of footwear. And cheaper food, clothing and footwear, which we will get when we are free to set our own economic policies.
Have cheaper food, cheaper shoes, cheaper bras. We can give people cheaper food, cheaper bras, cheaper shoes. It's a massive opportunity.
So you say.
Even if things did go wrong, let's just assume that things went wrong.
Yeah.
But the worst case scenario, economically, is better than where we are today.
But you know, that is the fact of the matter. These people are talking about taxing mobile wealth. Why aren't they talking about taxing wealth that is part of the country? If you own half of a county, you cannot move it to Dubai or even the Isle of Man.
So there's,
tax that.
So there's,
I think there's also this confusion that people have is, they're on the right, they're saying, what you're going to do is you're taxing income. It's not about taxing income. And those on the left who are saying we need to tax the wealth, maybe as Phil is saying, they're talking about taxing mobile wealth, when in reality it should be land taxes, or it should be going after assets, things that can't be moved, things that can't physically be moved.
Things that physically are part of this country.
Yeah, but if you're, as you said, you know, if you're a billionaire or even a multimillionaire, you can have an address in multiple countries. And then if the situation changes, you just switch the address to somewhere else. But you need to go after what's physically in the country. And we're not hearing that. We're not hearing people on the right saying about, you know, if somebody moves to Dubai and their assets are in the UK, well, it doesn't really make any difference because you're going after the assets.
Yes.
Well, they're not selling it like that on the right. What they're doing is they're selling, oh, well, all these people are leaving. They haven't been able to give us a list of names, unfortunately, but they're saying lots of people are going to Dubai or going to other places. But yeah, if their assets are in the UK, then of course they can be taxed there. And that should be the focus. Maybe it's because it doesn't sound sexy or something that people on the left are not pushing this, or it's just like maybe it's
then,
too complicated for some people.
It's easy. I don't know what they're up to because they don't talk to me, but no one has given me an answer why they're not promoting land tax when you can't move that, and they are promoting.
But I think Gary Stevenson has mentioned
Gary does. Yeah, I think
he still talks about taxing mobile wealth as well.
But I think Zach Polanski has also mentioned land tax. I'm not saying in a definite way. I think it was a passing comment of something he was considering.
Well,
so
maybe
I think
that's because
Labour
are considering it. He wants to try and, you know.
Maybe, yeah. but then, so there's a couple of things that, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because Isabel Oakenshot shot off abroad, didn't she? Yeah. As soon as she had to pay tax. And you're a bit like, you're a nationalist, but you don't want to contribute to the country. Isn't that interesting? And then your husband's also not complained about that or anything else. But you're like, okay, whatever. But then there's something within that. I don't think there are any stats to show. Last time I looked, it might have been about 6 months ago, I couldn't find any actual statistical data to show that people were leaving and that billionaires were leaving or millionaires were leaving. It's not to say it isn't happening. I just didn't see it. The other thing is culture. It's really easy to say you're going to move your money. But as soon as you go into a different culture, either you've got to learn their language, unless you're Brexiteers moving to Benidorm, in which case you enforce your culture on Spain, it's hard to adapt to. Like Isabel Oakenshot moving to Dubai, she's got a new set of rules that she's going to have to abide by, and maybe culturally she can't adapt. It's really easy to move the money, but is it really easy to move yourself into a new culture? For some, yes. And I'd say for a lot of people, especially Brits who don't learn second languages, it's far harder to do that. And I find very interesting about this billionaires leaving. There's no data. And it's not just as simple as moving cash. You've got to learn to. I mean, Max, you're living in Italy. Like, how long did it take you to adjust to Italian culture and language?
I'd actually disagree with that because I think people like Isabel Oakenshot, you know, she's Richard Tice's partner, so she doesn't have to worry about going down to the shop. She can just have a slave do it for her. So I don't think it's really a case. And maybe literally, as is the case with Dubai, but you. And because there are so many expats there or immigrants, whichever term you want to use, she doesn't really need, like, as you said, with Benidorm, you don't need to interact with the people there. It's not like moving to the middle of the countryside where you have to live in a village and interact with members of the public, or you have to go through the process. These people are rich enough to hire somebody else to do the work for them. So and of course, if they want, you know, I believe alcohol is banned in Dubai, but you know, if you have money, you can access pretty much anything. So, and if you're drinking it at home, then that's not a problem. So these people are not going to integrate. I find it funny that they're complaining about immigrants not integrating in Britain, not learning the language, not adopting to the culture. While I haven't seen Isabel Oakenshot wear a headscarf, or I haven't seen I haven't seen her pray three times a day or anything like that, but it's completely hypocritical. But the point is, it's not like normal people moving to a country, learning the language, going through the bureaucracy. These people are at another level, and they just pay somebody else to do all of the heavy lifting for them.
Oh, I'm so mixed about that because I know in football Sorry, Phil, I'll be quick. In football, you always had that stereotype, and actually, it turned out that a lot of footballers really tried to integrate. I mean, Joey Barton's French was abysmal in terms of an accent.
Never mind, I have a chance to save it. So for me, it's important that people speak about the qualities I bring as a footballer, and I'm a little bit bored, you know, from the English media, and hopefully the French media has more about it than the English media and concentrate on stupid little incidents like this.
But a lot of footballers have that money, and yet they will try and adapt to the culture. So I don't know.
That's a completely different thing, because footballers mostly do come from ordinary backgrounds, whereas billionaires were born billionaires. and you say about adapt to the culture. They don't have the British culture in the same way we do, because they will have grown up being well-travelled. The people they mix with, a lot of them are foreign anyway, right? So it doesn't matter for them whether they're living in London or Berlin or New York or Tokyo at that particular time of year. It's the same people that are their neighbours. They're all actually very multicultural there. You know, to say that they keep promoting anti-multiculturalism, they themselves are very multicultural. The other thing about stats is, as well, and this is always a problem when countering disinformation, is you will never get stats on anything for about a year and a half.
Mm.
Because, like, you can't... Anything that's happening today in 2025, we're not really going to get the stats on it until November 2026. You know, even when you get things like economic data, you know, a couple of months, you know, like... Yeah, at the moment, we've got the economic data, I think, for sort of June or something, maybe July, you know, and then a few months later, you have a revision. And then a year and a half later, you have another revision, because there's a lot of data that the ONS have to crunch through. So when they get the first lot through, you know, it's one. In fact, the ONS are coming under pressure at the moment, because quite a lot of the time they're having to revise things quite a bit. But that's because people are not feeding them the data they need. There's a problem at them, because it's based on people just replying to forms and things like that, and increasingly people aren't doing it these days. So a lot of the time with the stats, we are flying blind. But when it comes to the stats of people leaving the country, like I said, leaving the country means a completely different thing. If I were to leave the country, that would mean me no longer living in Britain and living in like France or Spain or something like that. Whereas for billionaire, it isn't. They've still got their home in London. They've still got their home in... They just change which one is their primary residence.
But isn't there changes. Like, if you move to France and you want residency, I guess you could bribe someone if you're rich enough. But don't you have to learn the language? Like,
you're supposed to get
French residency, wouldn't you have to? I assume Dubai, you probably don't.
There might be some countries that have things like that.
Mm.
But then you just go to Monaco or something, don't you? It's like France, but to they let anyone live there if you're rich enough.
No, yeah. But to be a citizen, you need to learn the language, but to be a resident, you don't. And these people
you
are
don't.
Just residents.
For residency, you don't.
I don't know about France, but in Italy, you don't need to be. You don't.
I think in France you do, and I think in Greece you do. To
I'd
have
be
a
surprised because residency is very different to citizenship. Like, for example, in Estonia, you don't even need to live in the country. You don't even need to be a physical resident. You can have a digital citizenship or digital residency, I should say.
Does that get you
I
an
could
EU
be
passport?
Wrong about that. Sorry?
Does that get you an EU passport?
No, I don't think so, because to get the EU passport, you have to be physically there. But to start a business in Estonia, you don't need to be physically in the country.
They were doing this. Didn't Cyprus and Malta get clobbered? Yeah. For giving out these,
I think they're still doing
passports.
It. They've been told to shut down within a few months or year.
Although the EU is very much, don't do that again. And yeah,
someone
we'll take it on board.
What did you? Just because we talk, actually, there is one quick question I'll ask both of you. Trigonometry guys, Konstantin Kishin has complained because you mentioned this earlier.
The guy who books.
I would say 75% of our bookers' energy is spent on trying to book left-wing guests.
Yeah, and every time we have a booking meeting, we go to him, Billy, how about some left-wingers? And he's like, I've tried.
Yeah.
I emailed them every month.
He's complained that they can never get anyone on the left onto his show. Would either of you guys go on the show?
I have never turned anyone down. No, actually, I tell a lie. I turned one person down, but they had nothing to do with politics. But in terms of, I have never, ever turned anyone down who said, oh, I'd like to talk about this thing on politics.
So you'd go on. Okay. Max?
Yeah, 100%.
I wouldn't necessarily physically go on. I'm a hermit, so they may have to do it by Zoom.
And for me, it's the same. It's a little bit difficult. But I saw that Jimmy the Giant went on, and it didn't go very well.
You didn't think? You weren't...
Well, he had gone on with the idea that he was going to debate politics, and then what they did was they caught him on something that he had said about them or one of them in a video, and the whole thing was about that. It was extremely boring. It was like two people complaining about, like, I'm a huge fan of Jimmy, and he I believe, I don't know if I can say this, but I think he eventually took down the video and they had some sort of agreement, but it was pointless. Like, people wanted to hear, oh, finally, you're going to have Jimmy the Giant on to talk about politics. And they didn't talk about politics. It was a shouting match. And it was
waste of time. That's your problem. You've got bad faith actors who say they want to debate and then don't debate. And it's full of it on the left and the right. There's full of people like that because they think it's more important than their rights than they actually inform.
It's interesting because like part of the philosophy of here was to bring progressives together, and we do have the odd debate. We make it a specialist debate. We don't, you know, a special episode instead of like the usual, because I don't feel as if progressive points of view get pushed out as much as they should, or as groups and connecting each other together. So that's interesting, but we still do it. But I would never act in a bad faith like they did. I think Jimmy showed the email that they sent. And it's exactly as you said, they made it quite clear that they wanted to debate the politics. And then in Constantine just made it all about himself, which was, what's the point? Just shouting at him to get you off the hook for being called a grifter. Seems a bit pointless, doesn't it?
So if you're able to organize a debate between someone on the right with one of us, go ahead, I think.
I've got a sneaking suspicion they'll probably like back out of it with you two and just be you've got to come down to the studio.
I know, but for me, it's not about, I'm not a huge fan of debates. I'm more interested in conversations. So, and I'm not being flippant about that. It's like, I think it's more interesting for people to talk about things they agree on and then maybe a little bit of disagreement, but that's not really good for YouTube. People just want, you know, stopwatches and, you know, a round table of knocking people out one after the other. It looks good for YouTube, but I don't think it's actually helpful for either side.
Did you feel that with the Jubilee episode with Mehdi Hasan versus those fucking far righters? Did you feel
it was wonderful theater, but it's not going to change anyone's minds because the people who agreed with him are going to agree with him, and the people who disagree with him are continuing to disagree. Their guy was knocked out, but they would be like, yeah, but I'm still going to, you know, subscribe to his channel and stuff like that, because I'm going to ignore that episode and I'm going to continue to support. But that's not good for people's minds. That's not going to improve the situation. So this sort of theater, I don't think it's helpful. It'd be much more interesting for him to sit down with somebody for an hour and have a discussion about different topics. But this sort of, okay, you have 30 seconds to get your point across.
I thought Luke Beasley did a really interesting segment for a bit. It stopped where he got a female MAGA supporter who was quite homophobic and racist on. And it was a weekly podcast where they kept talking about where they disagreed. But it then built up and you started to notice that she kept saying she was changing. She was like, I'm not going to put the homophobic thing on there because I quite like Luke. And I think it would upset him. And you're like, fuck, she's got empathy coming into her. And she's starting to think about other people. And I thought that was quite an interesting sort of dynamic to build in, where you're on for an hour a week just talking and trying to, as you said, build a conversation and seeing who can. I guess there's still an element of trying to re-persuade someone your point of view is the correct point of view as opposed to an actual conversation.
But it's very important to remember that we're not back in like 2010 or whatever, where people actually had their opinions and they understood, look, I want to put my point across and I want to have a proper discussion. It's all monetized now. So if you're, and it's generally on the right, it's probably also on the left somewhat, but generally on the right, it's your career, it's your livelihood that's at stake. So if you lose this, you'll end up losing money. So they have to win the debate or they have to avoid certain debates because there's a chance they will lose. I think even some of the people on the right don't really believe what they're saying, but they know that it's a money spinner. So that's why they're doing it. I'm not saying everyone is like that, but I think there's a significant number of them. Sometimes they get caught out. But generally, I think it's a case of now, if I'm an influencer on the right, all I have to do is just keep talking about immigration, talk about trans people, and I'm set up for life, or at least for the next number of years.
You've seen Dan Wooden's stats and numbers. And video content. It's fucking wild. That's all. So it's immigration, how great the monarchy is, and how horrible Harry and Meghan are. And that's, from what I've seen, I'm sure there's a few other segments, but from what I've seen, it's just that. He churns out 3 videos a day, and it's like 7 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 5 o'clock. He's got the viewing numbers are insane. And then he'll do 5 minutes where he slags off a particular group. And then he'll bring on 3 experts who'll then back up his point of view, how Meghan is just pure evil, the daughter of Satan, and trying to bring down Britain and the monarchy. And that's
I've just
it.
Brought it up, yeah, his channel, so on my little spy thing. Yeah, so in terms of his top things recently...
What's that Phil, your spy thing?
I have tools and stuff to spy on other people's YouTube channels. but it just collects them in one place. You can like click on certain channels and compare them to each other. So yeah. We've got here, she leaked it. Meghan Markle accused of secretly revealing Rose Hanbury and Prince William rumour, whatever the hell that is. It's over, new Meghan Markle crisis after biggest disaster ever as William plots Harry revenge.
How many views?
He has done one actually to do with Starmer and Elon Musk. Then what have we got? HRH title, curtsy and apology. Meghan Markle, shock demand. So let's have a look here. I've got a list of like 10 things from him, recent videos that have done well. Meghan Markle. Harry's mentioned there, so we'll class that as the same thing. Harry again. Meghan Markle. So 7 out of 10 of the best performing videos of the last, you know, of recent times. Yeah, 70% of them are Meghan Markle stroke Harry.
Jesus. What sort of views are they getting on?
Well, the individual videos, I mean, because these are quite recent, they may still run a bit. You're talking about, you know, 200,000, wow. 150 to 300,000 views. I mean, what I can see in the last 30 days, his channel has been getting about 900,000 views a day. It's a little bit more than ours. so, yeah, it's definitely getting the views in.
Isn't that wild? That is literally his format. It's 5 minutes of him giving his speech, generally negative about whatever he's talking about, and then brings on three experts who all agree with him pretty much. And back up.
There's also a team behind that as well. Yeah. I mean, he's not doing that himself. It's like doing something on the telly, but it's doing it on YouTube instead. So there's a production team behind that.
Do you think this type of stuff is all contributing to racism being out of control in Britain right now?
Or? Yeah,
no.
Yeah, because they're pushing disinformation.
Do you think racism is out of control in Britain at the moment?
I do, because it's not that the number of racists increase. There was always a sort of self-regulation, wasn't it? Things were very, very racist, openly racist in the 70s and the 80s, and then it got better in the 90s and the noughties. And it was like the racists were still there. I always point to Bernard Manning as a classic example. So in the 70s and 80s, he was on the telly. And then in the 90s and noughties, he wasn't. But he was still doing his thing. He's still doing his comedy shows, but in his own private club. So that's what happened. Racism went private. It was like behind closed doors.
You are racist, aren't you, Ben?
Yes. See, some people I like, some people I don't.
And people sort of understood the general society. Because most people are sheeple, right? Most people sort of understand the rules of society. And they tend to conform. A lot of people conform. And what's happened in the last 10 years is they now think they're the majority, so they're more open about it. So I don't think racism is necessary. I mean, it's very difficult without, you know, detailed studies. But I don't think racism itself has become more prevalent. But I think, you know, the instances in which racists think they can be openly racist, you know, has worsened in the last 10 years. I think the progress we were making has gone forward.
I also think that people used to blame certain problems on maybe the government or on single mothers and stuff like that. And I think over the last 10 years, the Conservatives in particular, because they were in power, they have been able to shift things over to, well, we need to find a new scapegoat, and the scapegoat is immigrants. So while people in the past would be angry about a lack of housing, they generally wouldn't blame immigrants on it for this problem. But now they are, because the mainstream media and the right-wing press and the government, you're back when the Conservatives were in charge, were able to convince people that, well, the problem is immigration. It's not because of us. It's not because we're not building enough houses. It's because of the immigrants. And members of the public were easily convinced, maybe it's the immigrants that's the problem, because everyone is saying it's the immigrants. So maybe, and then when it comes to the NHS, I can't get a doctor's appointment. Probably because we don't have enough doctors. No, it's not because of that. It's because there are too many immigrants. So they're getting this. And I think people have been radicalized. People who probably didn't have a problem with immigrants before are now becoming radicalized. Maybe radicalized isn't the right term, but they're certainly starting to reconsider, well, maybe the problem is immigration, because everyone's saying it. And more people are feeling comfortable about saying it, because the press and the government, the Tories, allowed, in a sense, allowed people to do that. And it's easy just to say, well, my problems in life are because of somebody else and not because of the government or because I'm not doing well myself. So I think I agree with Phil that the number of racists have not increased, but more and more people are being convinced that it's not the government, it's not rich people who are not paying their taxes or whatever. That's not the problem. The problem, of course, is these foreigners who are coming in. And then we hear also the rhetoric constantly, oh, they're getting everything for free. And people, obviously, you know, if you're struggling and you hear about somebody getting something for free and this person has just got off a boat, that's going to create resentment.
Mm.
And you're not hearing a proper pushback. You know, I try to explain in pretty much every video about how these people can't work. If they were allowed to work, they would be able to contribute. They have to be in hotels or they have to be in some sort of accommodation because the government have an obligation to provide housing for them so that they don't become destitute. But if you're a person struggling, if you're working 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, and you're just trying to get by, and then you're constantly being told, look at these people coming in, getting everything for nothing, a free phone, getting a house. And there was a story even this week how asylum seekers were being put in £300,000 luxury accommodation. Don't know how £300,000 is a luxury accommodation. Like where? Maybe in some very poor part of the country. But the right wing press and politicians are happy to sell the idea. It's not our fault. It's the immigrants, and more people are buying into that. That's the impression that I get.
I did a Vox Pop. I'm going to throw you some quick quiz questions from that Vox Pop and see what you think, because what you've all touched on is quite interesting. So what do you think, crime's gone up or down in the UK since the year 2000, reported crimes? So, Phil, what do you think?
Well, reported crimes has gone up because people...
Since 2000?
Yeah, because reporting, first of all, the population is greater, but also reporting has gotten better since then.
So you think it's gone up, Max?
Yeah, I imagine because of the population increasing, there are more crimes being reported.
It's halved.
Ah.
It was about 20 to 14 million reported. I think 20 million in 97, 14.8 million in 2000. It's now 8.7 reported crimes. You'll often get someone going, but, you know, people don't report crimes as much. And I'm going, well, we didn't used to have mobile phones, so it was harder to report. You'd have to get to a landline to report it, and some people wouldn't do that. So that's interesting. Is the biggest crime, like sector of crime, I don't know how, or genre of crime, do you think is taking place in the UK right now? What is the biggest? Max?
I would say fraud.
Fraud. Phil?
I would say fraud, specifically because the Tories removed fraud from their crime statistics when they were trying to show that they were doing a good job.
Why would they do something like that?
It's fraud. It's about 50% of all crime is fraud. And it cost the UK last year, the estimates was about 219 billion a year. The year before, 2 years before, I think it cost 197 billion a year. So fraud's going up and no one's talking about it.
And of course, benefit fraud is through the roof, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's not like the Tories like have had a long list of tax evasion, Zahawi, Mogg, Johnson, Dorries, Sunak's wife.
There's quite a lot of fraud going on in 2020.
Okay, what is the crime that's increased the most since Brexit? So 2013, 16. What is the crime that's increased the most? Phil?
I'd still say fraud.
You think fraud's increased the most? Okay, Max?
I don't know. I want to say something different because Phil had said fraud and we said fraud before.
You so
want to
win.
maybe knife crime?
I think knife crime's increased the most and you think fraud. Hate crime. Hate crime has increased 240%. Reported hate crime has increased 240% since Brexit. And I think one of the highest areas is assault to Muslims and the Jewish community, which has increased by 78%. So again, you're going, okay, so fraud is costing us 219 billion. Hate crime's through the roof. And I don't see any party talking about that and switching direction. And then, there's this thing I think you... Oh, actually, which one... As Nigel Farage said that he wants to set up an alligator Alcatraz in Britain, which do you think has got better living conditions? Alligator Alcatraz or Guantanamo Bay? Which has got the better living conditions? The terrorists who are trying to destroy our entire civilization, or the migrants who are escaping climate change and want a well-paid job? Which one do you think's worse? Phil?
You've basically just said the answer, haven't you?
Have I? Have I said the answer?
It'll be the Florida one. I mean, interestingly, even the American courts have said you've got to shut that down because it's a shithole.
Max, do you agree?
Yeah, I think Guantanamo Bay is much better. Also because of the numbers as well. There are much fewer people in it.
It's pretty much, yeah. Guantanamo Bay is a nicer place than what Nigel Farage wants to build. And like I was watching a documentary where they were showing people around 11 years ago, and it was like, here's the library, here's the computer games room. Our favorite book is Harry Potter, so we make sure we have multiple copies of that. We've got loads of games, lots of soccer games, because that's the least contentious and won't rile up the terrorists. And you're like, fuck.
As long as you know,
they've never seen Millwall play, then have they?
Can we? Just because we're at the end, I know there were a number of topics we wanted to talk about today, but I just wanted to go over the Epstein stuff just for 5-10 minutes. And in Congress, just to update viewers, because it hasn't been reported in the British press, Republicans and Democrats have come out and said, and big MAGA supporters have come out and said, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the White House, and possibly Trump are covering this up. And they're in the list, and there's wealthy, powerful people. But the other one that blew me a little bit was there are claims that Epstein was a foreign agent and working for a foreign country to operate these rings. What were your thoughts on Epstein and in Congress this week, Max?
I've always been skeptical of conspiracy theories, but when it comes to, over the last number of years, I've had to embrace them in somewhat. So this idea that Epstein would be a foreign agent, if you had asked me a few years ago, I'd say, no, that's just ridiculous. But I don't know, it's possible. He had a lot of dirt on a lot of people. And of course, Trump didn't want to release the list because he's obviously on it. And people who are close to him are obviously on it. But I keep coming back to this point. Would it make any difference to MAGA supporters if it comes out that he is on the list? Would it make any difference to them if there was videos of him engaging in illegal behavior with, you know, people on the island? I don't really think at this stage it would make it, because they're so embedded in the cult that no matter, he would just say, well, you know, it's I did it. Wonderful. There, done. You know, there would be a bit of a hullabaloo about it for a few days and then it would go away. I understand the Democrats are using it as a weapon against Trump, and there are even some Republicans. But my fear is that it'll be flavor of the month or it'll be a 15-minute thing, and then it will just go away. And then Trump will go back to what he's doing, which is filling his pockets and destroying the Constitution. So I'm a little bit downbeat about this. I know it's something that a lot of people are really concerned about, but I think it will eventually be released. But the impact that people hope it will have on Trump, I think, will not be as severe as we had hoped.
Ooh, that is downbeat. That's so downbeat. go on, Phil. What were your thoughts?
I mean, I've got multiple thoughts on this. I can't, for the life of me, understand why Trump is so reticent, because clearly he will be implicated. I mean, in terms of the foreign agent thing, what I would say is it's entirely plausible, because Epstein had so many influential people from around the world as part of his circles that would inevitably make him a target for, you know, KGB types, for example, because he'd be a very useful person to get on your side. So I could absolutely believe that Jeffrey Epstein would be a target for foreign spies, effectively foreign agents. But in terms of like the damage to Trump, I don't understand for the life of me why he's so reticent about it, because this is why I couldn't understand why he was kicking back against it so much. I actually thought he probably would release it, because what can there, even if we know he's deeply implicated himself, he can just claim this week when he did his I'm Not Dead press conference, someone asked him later on, they showed him footage of a rubbish bag being thrown out of a White House window. And instead of just, the White House had already admitted that it happened, some people, workmen doing it. But he felt he had to say it was fake news. It was a faked video just for the hell of it. He would just say that. I mean, any footage related to the Epstein files concerning him would be sort of oldish. It wouldn't be like great quality, probably, which means they could easily pass it off as fake news. And would it matter anyway? I mean, you could have footage of this man's babies and his cult still wouldn't abandon him. It'd just say they were Democrat babies. Yeah. Like, I honestly don't know why. He clearly is. Trump clearly thinks it's damaging. You know, the suggestions that Putin has stuff related to the Epstein files on him. And again, he clearly thinks that's damaging, because when he had that meeting with Putin, when he came out of it, he did not look, his body language was all wrong. He'd come out of it shell-shocked. So, and I can't understand for the life of me what it is.
I think there's loads of little things that give away a bit more of a pattern. So one of the when Epstein worked for, I think it's Bear Stern, I'll double check that. They were in a Ponzi scheme. They got caught out, and then one of the guys who was arrested and jailed, who worked with Epstein, was claimed on camera that Epstein had told him he wouldn't be jailed because he works for the DOJ. There was two incidents where women reported to the FBI and the local police about Epstein. One went nowhere. I think that was the Santa Monica police. The other was to the FBI, and that was Maria Farmer, who claimed that. She also then claimed that she got a phone call from Maxwell about a month later saying, why are you telling the FBI? We've done stuff to you. Stop it. And then got another phone call from Epstein. And you go, okay, is Maria Farmer lying? Probably not. What is going on there? Is the guy with the Ponzi scheme claim that he was working for the DOJ? Is he talking nonsense? I don't know. And you, as you said, Max, we're going to conspiracy territory. I think Trump's clearly in the fires. I mean, he had a report. It was Joanna Doe filed against him and Epstein in New York and California that he and Epstein attacked her. I mean, here's a kicker for you. There is more evidence to show that Trump is connected to Epstein than there is Bill Clinton, yet Bill Clinton's been put up in front of Congress. And Bill Clinton's been talked about less in the press. And yet Donald Trump isn't being pulled up in front of Congress. And nor would he be, because Congress is Republican-owned. But you're going, there was so much evidence. I mean, even the tape, you were saying that not much happened over the summer. The tape that came out that the FBI said they were going to release and would be completely legit, turns out was edited, had a minute missing. And there's a bloke, after everyone's been locked down, there's a bloke walking up the stairs at 10:48 and everyone got locked into their rooms at around 7. And there's no explanation for it. And yet the FBI said there was no one walking around. You can't, like, this is just like, this is up there in terms of conspiracy with Amelia Earhart or JFK, and we're living through it. This is the level of conspiracy that we're witnessing here. And I don't know where to go with it, as you guys have both said. Why is Trump hiding this? What's the reason? Well, most likely he's in the Epstein files. Most likely this is going to damage him. And the polling's showing that, by the way. The polling's showing that this is the one thing that's actually damaged him. And
but
the polling's
claiming,
I think, 30 to 38%. Have dropped of not dropped interest in Trump, but are angry at Trump about it.
But I think people are more upset about the economy, more upset about things that directly impact them. So if it's like polling, I don't think it really makes any difference. Like, I honestly don't know why he's so adamant about not releasing it. He's so against this because there's nothing really for him to lose. Like, it's not like he's some moral figure that this would be extremely damaging. Like, there's nothing. As Phil has said, there's nothing he could do that would cause him to lose his base. I've often joked before, maybe if he converted to Islam, that would be probably the only way he'd lose his base. But from a moral point of view, there's nothing. Tax evasion, corruption, cozying up to dictators, you know, welcoming Nigel Farage into Mar-a-Lago. There's nothing he could do that would damage his base. So apart from maybe converting to Islam, because that may be, you know, a step too far for some of them.
Any thoughts from you, Phil?
Well, I agree. I honestly, I'm curious. I honestly don't know. What I do know is, I mean, Max talks about people most interested in the economy. Sure they are. That's not exactly heading in the right direction for those voters. So, you know, if I'm the Democrats, I'd absolutely 100% get behind this, because what I would be thinking to myself, there'll be a lot of people, if you actually did release the unredacted Epstein files, there'd be a lot of people, Democrat and Republican, in the frame there. If I was the Democrats, I'd be thinking, that's the old guard. We need to shed those anyway because we need the new generation in. And I'd be thinking, sod it. You know, if you have to chuck a few. I suppose the worry would be if there's a few donors in there. But I would still take the view, what good are donors if you can't win power? So if I were the Democrats, I'd properly go into this and I'd say, if we can flip the Senate and the House, I don't know how realistic that is after the midterms, then we're going to really push for these things to be released. And if he still won't, if we still can't get them released, then the next Democrat candidate for president will go, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to get these released. And we mean it.
Well, the victims have said they're releasing their own list, which is fucking wild. And it's, and they keep saying, alluding to the fact that it's the richest men in America, in the world.
Yeah,
that are on
this
list.
Be.
Yeah, it will be. Makes you go, is that Elon Musk as well? I don't know. I'm just asking questions.
I like Nigel Farage.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You guys are awesome, bye-bye, as usual. Like, great show. Bye, everyone.
Tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
X-Files time. Black Mirror time. Max, you're stuck in a lift with Liz Truss and a lifetime supply of cheese, or Rishi Sunak with a broken iPad trying to explain what leveling up really was. Who's the lesser evil? Who do you want to be trapped with?
Well, maybe the Liz Truss with the cheese. That's more appealing. You can just ignore her and just eat the cheese.
You don't think the smell will be too overpowering? I'm talking about Liz Truss. Okay. So it's Rishi Sunak with the... So it is Liz Truss, but you'd have the cheese. Okay. Phil, Desert Island box set. Do you go, yes, minister, but every episode has been remade by GB News? Or The West Wing with Nigel Farage playing President Bartlett?
Well, I'd do The West Wing because I never watched that anyway, so we can't ruin it.
Max, you're in a courtroom, Twilight Zone. You're going to play the role of defense solicitor, and you've got to defend either Suella Braverman or Priti Patel.
Probably Priti Patel. She's pretty evil, but it would be easier to defend her than Suella Braverman.
Yeah, but if you were defending her, you're not a defense lawyer, so they'd be found guilty, so wouldn't you want to defend Suella Braverman and get her thrown away?
Yeah.
Good point.
Do you want the victory or do you want the conviction?
like the mafia lawyers, they knew that, okay, I'll defend these guys because I make lots of money out of it and fame. So yeah, maybe Suella Braverman would be a better choice.
Phil, you've got to tutor one or the other about UK politics.
Right.
Do you tutor Elon Musk or Donald Trump?
Oh, Donald Trump, in a shot.
Why is that?
I have immense fun with that. Because he's actually really quite simple. I think, you know, I would have a lot of fun trying to teach Donald Trump simple things. Plus, of course, he's more influential. You know, you might actually get something through to him. Like, worst case scenario, he sacks me. But you might get something through. You might actually do some good. You can do no good with Elon Musk. He's gone. He's, you know, he's finished.
You reckon he's got
as a human
money.
Being? As a human being, I mean, there's no redeeming Elon Musk. Donald Trump, you might be able to get a few. You might be able to get a few things through to him. Like appealing to his sense of, you know, because all he wants is he wants to be like the greatest, and he wants to be rich and famous and in power and stuff like that. And you can, I think you can use that to sort of nudge him towards some other areas where he'll do better out of it.
Who do you think would be the more frustrating, and who would be the funnier?
I think Elon Musk would be the more frustrating one, because he I don't think you can teach him anything. Like when he took over Twitter, the engineers tried to explain to him how it worked and he couldn't get it, whereas Trump can tell the difference between a lion and an elephant, at least so he says.
And it was 30 or 35 questions. The first questions are very easy. The last questions are much more difficult.
like a memory question. It's like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV.
I took the test, too, when I heard that you passed it.
Yeah, how did
it's
you
not
do
the hard, well, it's not the hardest test.
No, but the
it
last...
It has a picture, and it says, what's that? And it's an elephant.
No, no, no. You see, that's all misrepresentation.
Well, that's what it was on the web.
It's all misrepresentation.